Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 50, right at the beginning, which is old single column, page 572. Okay, so having finally wrapped up paper 49, going through all those details about the inhabited worlds in terms of the inhabitants of mortal status, all right, they're going to bring in some of the inhabitants of immortal status that are related to the evolutionary worlds. You have the, eventually comes to pass that every world gets a planetary prince and all of the individuals that support that prince. So that you have the beginnings of an official planetary government. Certainly a very exciting disclosure of the fifth epical revelation that there is much, much more to this world than meets the eye. There is a very elaborate, long-standing civilization of non-human nature, all kinds of different celestial beings. There are those that come and go, do their tour of duty on our world. Then there are those that are really the long-term inhabitants that from our perspective we'd think of as celestial beings, but they're, technically they're terrestrial beings. They're just not as corporeal as we are. But there's this whole elaborate phenomenon that's going on unseen on this planet. And in general, humans haven't believed in such a fact. Because they assume that if there was, as it were, God's government here on Earth, that we would be living enlightened life. That God's government would make an idyllic Havona-like place on any planet where they were. But that's not the case. We don't live in Havona. We live in an evolutionary domain. And the most difficult challenge of the celestial beings that are stationed on the world that are that planetary government and all of the visitors and whatnot, the biggest challenge is for them to not fall into that trap of wanting to short-circuit the evolutionary process, to let their awareness of ideals get ahead of things. Right? It's a long, long evolutionary process for a seemingly endless sequence of ideas to move ever so slowly toward the ideals. And especially when you're talking about the planetary prince and his staff, and especially in the very early stages of when they're there, they go from Gerasim, in our case, where we were reading about not too long ago, a very, relative to what we understand, a very idyllic place, to a very lowly, just barely more than animal creature sphere. And they have to patiently just oversee, not meddle in any inappropriate way, but, patiently oversee the slow evolutionary process. They come long before biologic evolution has even reached its apex, let alone intellectual evolution, spiritual evolution, cosmic evolution. All right, so we'll get into some of those challenges later in this paper. But initially, they want to just give us some of the basics. So for those of you who are familiar with the revelation, it's always good to get a little review of the basics to remind yourself of exactly how this all hangs together. So let's jump in and see what they have to say here.
Paper 50, The Planetary Princes. While belonging to the Order of Lunanidek Sons, the planetary princes are so specialized in service that they are commonly regarded as a distinct group. After their Melchizedek certification as secondary Lunanideks, these local universe sons are assigned to the reserves of their order on the constellation headquarters. From here, they are assigned to various duties by the system sovereign and eventually commissioned as planetary princes and sent forth to rule the evolving inhabited worlds.
Okay, so just remember that one little detail, hearkening back to when we talked about the local universe sons and the Lunanideks, that in the case of the secondary Lunanideks, unlike the tertiary and the primary, they're basically just for, created just for the job of planetary princes. Remember there was just relatively a handful more than the 10 million that you need for 10 million inhabited worlds, roughly 10 million inhabited worlds in a local universe. So that's what they're reminding you of there. That you have this quite specialized group of Lunanideks that even if they're in the reserves for a while and are quote-unquote assigned to various duties, it's all to the eventually there, that you see eventually commissioned as planetary princes. That's the whole basic point. And now occasionally, like in our case, we had one of those secondary Lunanideks also as an assistant to our planetary prince. But obviously that's not part of the regularly scheduled programming. I mean, you'd need just as many, for assistance as you'd have for the planetary prince. And there's just a little bit over 10 million. So you don't have that. So see, just the number, and this reminding you of the specificity is that, that's not the rule, that there's two secondary Lunanideks like we had. We'll get into that in just a little bit. There's all kinds of variability in the staff. But the basic idea is you've got these secondary Lunanideks, and it's pretty much one of them for each of the inhabited worlds. We don't know how close we are to 10 million. It's plus or minus whatever. They don't give us an exact number because it varies from local universe to local universe. They can't create exactly 10 million. The fact that there's a little bit more, just reminding you of that. That it isn't exactly 1,000 inhabited planets for each local system. It's just approximately. All right, one more little paragraph here in the preface.
The signal for a system sovereign to act in the matter of assigning a ruler to a given planet is the reception of a request from the life carriers for the dispatch of an administrative head to function on this planet, whereon they have established life and developed intelligent evolutionary beings. All planets which are inhabited by evolutionary mortal creatures have assigned to them a planetary ruler of this order of sonship.
Okay, yeah, so that other little reminder that a short or a long period of time when you actually have the first will creatures and when you get the planetary prince on that world, the life carriers are in charge, just like they've been in charge, all the way through the whole evolutionary process before the first will creatures. So the life carriers are handing off this planetary oversight to the planetary prince. And sometimes they totally retire. You might remember that reading about the life carriers. A lot of times they stay like they did here. They got permission, to stay here. But, they step out of the leadership position and the planetary prince takes over.
And interesting when they write the story about our planetary prince and the life carrier who's writing it, talks about the time he was there when he got assigned to it and had no idea that he would be rebellious, so to speak. Remember that part?
Eventually we'll get to that discussion of specifically of our planetary prince. They'll mention occasionally the specificity of us, but you can see this is, this paper is not just about our planetary prince, it's the planetary princes. It's about planetary princes in general. And bringing up our specificity, remember, that was one of the things that was very exceptional. This whole bit about waiting for the life carriers to request, in our case, you had 500,000 years of will creatures before that request went up to Gerasim for Lucifer to send us a planetary prince. And that reminds you of what we'll get into here, that something, yes, we had will creatures, but apparently the favorable conditions were not in place for 500,000 years. I mean, what was lacking? 500,000 years ago is when you had the Sangiks, right? I mean, the life carriers were waiting for you to finally have the Sangik races before they requested, a planetary prince. Because those pre-Sangik peoples, the Andonites, were of a very limited nature. Too limited for what the planetary prince is coming to do. Just kind of tease you with that. We'll see as we get into it exactly what is it specifically that a planetary prince is needing certain favorable conditions for. What exactly is he coming to do? Besides being ruler, world ruler, what kind of an uplifting job does he come to do? All right, might say something about that to start with here with this next section.
Number one, mission of the princes. The planetary prince and his assistant brethren represent the nearest personalized approach, aside from incarnation, that the eternal son of paradise can make to the lowly creatures of time and space. True, the creator's son touches the creatures of the realms through his spirit, but the planetary prince is the last of the orders of personal sons extending out from paradise to the children of men. The infinite spirit comes very near to the persons of the guardians of destiny and other angelic beings. The universal father lives in man by the pre-personal presence of the mystery monitors. But the planetary prince represents the last effort of the eternal son and his sons to draw near you. On a newly inhabited world, the planetary prince is the sole representative of complete dignity springing from the creator son, the offspring of the universal father and the eternal son, and the divine minister, the universal daughter of the infinite spirit.
Okay. So, notice how much time they spent on that, trying to really get you to get precisely in on this. Don't think of a planetary prince as a downstepped expression of the Father. Don't think of them as a downstepped expression of the conjoint actor. They are a downstepped expression of the eternal Son in terms of their mission. What exactly... fundamentally, they embody and minister to us. It's the essence of the eternal Son. It's not even something involving the mother. It's not the Father. It's not the Spirit. It's not the mother. Anything else you can think of. It's precisely the Son ministry. And wait a minute. We've been talking about life carriers a little bit. Don't they call them sons? And don't you kind of think of them maybe as, in some ways, lower than a Lananadec? They come to inhabited worlds. What about material sons, right? And don't they come and draw very near? They're wanting you to reflect a little bit here, to tell you point blank that this is the the most downstepped expression. So think about material sons and daughters. Well, first of all, there's material sons and daughters. Now, collectively, you call them material sons. But what do they? They don't represent so much a downstepped expression of the son. You know, they're created solely by the Creator's Son, the material sons and daughters, right? As an expression of that internal father-mother differential within the Creator's Son. You know, so the son part within the Creator's Son is not really in play. You know, in terms of the innate character. You know, and here, like they mentioned, even though the Creator Son and the Creative Mother Spirit are involved in creating a Lenanandek, they synchronize in a precise way so that really what you're getting most fundamentally is a downstepped expression of the Eternal Son in a Lenanandek. Or the life carriers. You know, again, remember, there isn't just the Creator Son and the Creative Mother Spirit involved in their parentage. There's a third parent, right? One of the Ancients of Days is involved, right? And so there's Trinity nature there. So again, it's not so much this more of a pure expression of the Eternal Son, you know, downstepped. Yeah, so that's they want you to just think about that. That in terms of just the descending order of sons from precisely the Eternal Son. This is the bottom of the ladder, extending down from paradise.
So, Chris, is that also all Lenanandeks, or is it just the planetary prince?
Yes, it's all Lenanandeks. It's just that, like, you know, they're saying it's the secondary ones here that, you know, go down to actually in
the
world.
Sun, right?
But they're all an expression of the sun. Yes.
So they must have had a lot of free will to go astray.
Yeah, and they're going to mention that here in just a little bit. Right. But it's just, you know, the first thing they want to think about is that the whole point is to not put a representative of the Father on the world, but a representative of the Eternal Son, you know, which, you know, should, they don't want, they're trying to challenge you out of your monotheistic mode. See, just right away in the first little thing they're saying here. Right? They want you to, you know, give the Eternal Son and the Infinite Spirit equal play in your worldview, which most humans don't. I mean, most Urantia Book readers don't. I mean, everything is still the Father because we're all just steeped in that traditionally. You know, we're very biased, you know, to have the Father doing everything. You know, and remember, it's really the opposite. The Father's perspective is, I'm going to try to find someone to do everything I can get him to do, you know, and if there's no one that's worthy of the job, okay, I'll do it, right? But basically, if I can delegate it, I'm going to delegate it. You know, it's really kind of the opposite of what humans have always thought, where the Father does everything. And, I mean, his first thought was, I'm going to do nothing, but then it's like, well, okay, but there's a handful of things that no one else can do, and so okay, I have to do those. Right? Rather than, I'm going to do everything, but maybe I'll give you a little breadcrumb to play with. Right? That's the way humans have always thought about it. The exact opposite of the reality of the Father. The Father's the most removed fact, not the most intimate fact.
Yeah. So, do you think that also has to do with the fact that we're from, you know, the seventh super universe that's a Father, Son, and Spirit kind of mixture, as opposed to another super universe that may have a different take on a planetary prince, so to speak? And our whole journey, really, at the end, you know, we become, you know, more adapt to the Father, Son, and Spirit because we are from this particular universe?
There's all of that, you know, the differences of super universes, you know, even the differences of local universes, one from another. Those are obviously also in play, but it starts with what they just said is true of every planet in every super universe, right? That a Lenanandek sun is the most downstepped expression of the sun on a planet. Right? It actually comes eye to eye, basically, with evolutionary mortals. And that Lenanandek sun is just like the rest of us. They exist in a certain environment. And that environment changes one local universe to another, one super universe to another, right? So they have to coordinate their nature with that environment. But, you know, it's not the case that they are, that environment is incarnate in them, right?
They don't become expression of right. Father and another.
Yeah, type exactly, type. Right, see? right, so there's the challenge of, you know, of synchronizing with the environment, you know, that they all have different from one local universe and one super universe to another. All right, let's see, anything else there? Let's see, you know, just, you know, of course they threw in the parenthetical. I mean, obviously, magisterial sons and creator sons draw even closer in incarnation. But aside from that, right, and you know, probably in that case, you know, since you're just focusing on the sun, remember when a creator son is doing it, you know, he's doing it in that father mode, his seventh bestowal. You know, so it's more like the avonal sons, the magisterial sons, when they're in incarnation mode. You know, they're more precisely a downstepped expression of the eternal sun at an even lower level. You know, that he who has seen me has seen the sun, you know, has seen the eternal sun, sort of thing, right? That a normal bestowal sun is functioning like. Right. So, you know, so in our case, it, you know, since we didn't get an avonal sun as an incarnation sun, I mean, this really is even more true for us, that the planetary prince is the, you know, is the most downstepped expression of the eternal sun that we're ever going to get.
Right? We're not getting one.
Yeah. Right, and yeah.
We're going to have a downstep.
Right, yeah. Now, and so, yeah, we've got that whole issue. Good. Right. Yeah. Anyway, okay, so what else do they say here?
The prince of a newly inhabited world is surrounded by a loyal core of helpers and assistants and by large numbers of the ministering spirits. But the directing core of such new worlds must be of the lower orders of the administrators of a system in order to be innately sympathetic with and understanding of the planetary problems and difficulties. All of this effort to provide sympathetic rulership for the evolutionary worlds entails the increased liability that these near-human personalities may be led astray by the exaltation of their own minds over and above the will of the supreme rulers.
Okay, so two things there. Since we already started it, let's start at the end of the paragraph there. This whole bit of the environment we were just talking about that each of these planetary princes functions in. Right, that's what they're speaking to. Right, they have to put themselves in cooperative subordination to that greater environment in which they exist and function and quote-unquote rule. You know, it's not an unqualified sovereignty. And, you know, fundamentally, you know, that's why they said supreme rulers like they did there. I mean, fundamentally, that Lindonendeck needs to recognize that he functions within the context of God the Sevenfold. Not just, you know, creator son, creator mother spirit, or, you know, his boss on Gerasim, or, you know, or any sort of thing like that. I mean, fundamentally, you know, the what's bringing the greater environment downstepped into a domain is that downstepping fact of God the Sevenfold. You know, so that when a rebellion occurs, like we had in our local system, the contrast is between that rebellious individual or, you know, group of individuals and God the Sevenfold. Right? In our case, with Satan, you know, giving Lucifer the designation of the God of Liberty, right? The contrast, you know, the discussion on Gerasim was between whether or not to follow the God of Liberty or God the Sevenfold. And again, I'm stressing that because, you know, you're never going to think something like that if you're biased to monotheism, right? It's not a philosophic contrast between God the Father and the God of Liberty, right? It's between God the Sevenfold and the so-called God of Liberty. And so that's, you know, and that's why you have foreign potentates, you know, as part of, you know, the Lucifer Manifesto and that sort of thing. That complex deity environment is the challenge for these rulers, and eventually, when we can get into it more, for us to come to terms with. It's not just you and the Father and the universe be damned, right? And I say it that way because, why does someone go off in rebellion like this? It's because the initiator, you know, doesn't initiate you as part of a group. The Father initiates you as an absolute individual, you know, and in that relationship, there isn't anyone else. There isn't anything else. Okay, and it's just you and the Father. And if you don't have an awareness of the Father strong enough, so what are you left with then in that initial state, that initial reference frame that you're thinking in? You, that's it. And then potentially infinite exaltation of that singular fact, you, right? The Father is the one that starts this problem, as it were, right? He's the one that gives you the potential to go off like this and think you're an island universe. Because it appears that you are, if all you see is the Father. He makes it appear as if you are unto yourself. Because that's the way he relates to you. There's not even another automaton in this, in the space at the same time, let alone another being. There's nothing but you and the Father. You know, and if you don't see the Father, then there's just you there, right? And that's where Lucifer went. That's where everyone goes. It's very important at some point to go beyond just the Father, because if you don't, there's potential danger there.
You know? So far, evolutionarily, we as people living here, just, you know, even to get to the Father is a step forward from where. Before.
Right, but
so, what you're saying is that
yeah, you know, is that greater that even greater step, and
we first have to realize it's there.
Right. Yeah, but just see that the difficulty that, like I was just saying, and they're going to mention it specifically here in just a little bit. Are you literally going to see the Father? No, not for a very, very long time. Right. So it remains an abstract relationship. See, and it's, but I can see my hands, I can see me, but I can't see the Father. So it's very easy to just think that there's, nothing in that complete space, that you start in, but you. Yeah, that's the tricky thing. Lucifer couldn't see the Father, but more and more he could see himself, and eventually that's all he could see. You know, and the Father didn't step in and prevent that by saying, oh, you're going astray. Now, see me? No. All right? The Father's not going to do that. And the Father remains aloof like that, right? And because he does, there's a danger there. Great positive potential in what he gave you, but an equal measure of negative potential. Every measure of creativity that he initiated you with comes with an equal measure of destructivity. Every measure of potential to see him comes with an equal measure to not see him, right? As much as you can open your eyes and see him, you can close your eyes and not see him. And he can't make it so that you don't have both, right? And there's not. And what did Jesus say about that? There's none so blind as those who will not see, right? And that's what I'm talking about. The very fact that I can consecrate my will to the perfect will of God the Father, that I can open my will eyes and see him, I can equally close my will eyes and not see him and see only myself, only the backs of my eyelids, to see only myself in that relationship. It's completely, you know, there's nothing fancy that you have to think about, really, to understand how a Lanonendek can go astray. As they're just pointing out, you know, and what they've said up front, they're very, very near to you, and you know, in the big scheme of things, right? So when you reflect on how you could go astray, you understand completely how they can go astray. You know, don't let all of the greater complexities of Gerasim or whatnot, you know, cloud the issue for you. Because again, the problematic space doesn't have the beauties of Gerasim in it, you know, or other creatures. It's just you and maybe the Father, and there's nothing else in that initial space. And so if you close your eyes, it's just you. It doesn't matter if you're standing on Gerasim or if you're standing here. Right? You go to the exact same you know, solipsistic space. Right? Okay.
What's that word?
Solipsistic, soul, self, space. And there's nothing but you, nothing but yourself. That's the beginnings of the descent, is solipsism. It goes downhill from there. Okay, so, you know, but, you know, it's like, well, don't make them so near to us then. It's like, well, then they're of no use to us, right? They have to be near to us so they can relate to where we are and help us with where we are. You can't
they don't go astray.
Yeah, an archangel can't be, you know, an archangel can't be a planetary prince. They're just way too, you know, above us in nature, right? There's no way they can relate to the job of being a planetary prince.
Well, Melchizedek, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Be morph.
All right. Okay, so just, you know, I just wanted to really stress that, because see, you know, you think about what they put up front, you know, stressing this bit about how they're down to the expression of the sun, and then speaking of supreme rulers like that, they're trying to expand your worldview so that you understand how these guys fit into the picture. You know, without kludging them into your old monotheism, right? Which means you're going to have a totally false notion of them. Okay. All right, what else do they say?
Being quite alone as representatives of divinity on the individual planets, these sons are tested severely, and Nebadon has suffered the misfortune of several rebellions. In the creation of the system sovereigns and the planetary princes, there occurs the personalization of a concept that has been getting farther and farther away from the universal Father and the eternal Son, and there is an increasing danger of losing the sense of proportion as to one's self-importance and a greater likelihood of failure to keep a proper grasp of the values and relationships of the numerous orders of divine beings and their gradations of authority. That the Father is not personally present in the local universe also imposes a certain test of faith and loyalty on all these sons.
Yeah, a certain, you know, a definitive test. Okay, so why don't we start with that last thing, since I was just saying they were about to say that, right? Reminding you that again. I mean, they've been doing that ever since we started part two. Right? The Father is not personally present out here. Period. Right? The exact opposite of what humans have always thought. Right? That, if nothing else, sets the fifth epical revelation apart from the expectations of all mortals on this planet. Right? They're looking for a book that tells them about how incredibly, fantastically, personally present the Father is to assuage their fears. You know, it's like, it appears the Father isn't present. You know, I'm looking for a book that tells me that it's not as it appears. Well, you didn't find it. You found a book that tells you, nope, it's exactly the way it appears. That appearance is reality. It's not merely an appearance. He really is not personally present, period. Right? So that's, like I said, see, they bring this challenge to monotheism to a head right away. Right? And they go, well, why isn't he personally present? We talk about that all the time. If he was even minusculely personally present out here, there wouldn't be an out here.
It's all gone.
If there was one, cubic meter of his personal presence out here, the entire master universe would get sucked into that and disappear. Right? He can't be personally present, or he would take a hold of it and there wouldn't be an other. Right? He must be absolutely not personally present. So that there can be an other. So that's the initial environment that you're thinking of. So again, like I said, the fact that he initiates you, he is the one who initiates all these parts. He's the individuality of the parts. So you've that challenge of finding something besides yourself in that initial space that you're created in, that space where we're all created equal, that initial father-creator space, to find something besides yourself there is not easy because he's not personally present. Right? And so you have to fundamentally be sensitive to a fact that's more subtle than that, right? Now, I often speak in relative terms as the father is a laser beam relative, to finding God the mother. But what I'm just saying right now should just remind you of just how much more difficult it is to find God the mother, right? If it's this difficult to even find God the Father, because he doesn't make it easy by just being personally present and boom, there he is. So see what else they say here. See, one of the things they say is the other half of what I was just talking about, and there is an increasing danger of losing the sense of proportion as to one's self-importance. Right? See, if you don't definitively find the Father in that initial space, right, all can happen is an ever greater false exaltation of self, right, unto just absolute self-righteousness. Right? And then the other thing, and a greater likelihood of failure to keep a proper grasp of the values and relationships of the numerous orders of divine beings and their gradations of authority. And just trying to read through that, your mind kind of goes numb and you don't even really get to the end of the sentence. Right? I don't know what all those words mean. What are they talking about there? All of that elaborate complexities of God the sevenfold. Right? The gradations of authority. Right? We're talking about God the sevenfold. Right? That hierarchy. Failure to recognize that you exist in the hierarchy that is predicated on a deity hierarchy of God the sevenfold. That's the failure. Not having God, not sharing the inner life with God so that there can be some innate humility, and then failing to recognize the environment that you're in, of God the sevenfold and all that complexity. All right, so you have some?
Yeah, I'm sort of reminded of when he who has seen me has seen the Father, and the aspect of the fact that even though, as you were saying, God is not personally present, however, in a way that's probably beyond our real understanding from experience, he is actually very present in the Creator's sons and in a way, makes himself present. And yet, it's probably in a way it's really hard to really totally understand. But you know where I'm going with this
right,
at all?
Right, right.
So it's
And
it's not like
right. So there's a truth there, or Jesus wouldn't have said it, right? You have seen me, and seen the Father. I mean, after all, they just mentioned it. I mean, one of the Creator Son's two parents is Universal Father. Right, so definitely the universal, some nature, aspect of the nature of the Universal Father is literally innate within him. But even in that, right, I mean, if you can read all of part four of the book, and you're comfortable in that space. But if you read the paper at the end of part three about the seventh bestowal, how do they challenge that, what ends up being a overly simplified thought? On his seventh bestowal, is he actually conforming to the will of the Universal Father? You guys remember? Right? There's seven bestowals, right? He's conforming one at a time to seven different wills, right? Why are there seven different flavors of will? Because there are seven infinite persons? No, there's only three infinite persons, right? And it's the seven wills of the seven. It's the seven wills of the seven master spirits, right? On the seventh bestowal, technically, I mean, Jesus, literally 2,000 years ago, is not going to bring in this technicality. But before part four, they bring in the technicality. Technically, he's not conforming his will to the Universal Father's will. He's conforming his will to one of the master spirits' will. Which one?
Probably number one.
Right, the first master spirit.
Right.
It's actually the will of the first master spirit that he's consecrating his will to. Right? That's way too complicated for, fishermen and whatnot 2,000 years ago. You can't bring in the seven wills of the seven master spirits. So he just goes with the truth of it, right?
But when you take him up even to being Creator Son, forget about Jesus.
Yeah.
Here again, is that the same thing, or is he really, as you say, as part of the sevenfold? Is he really, in a way, doesn't he have an expression of,
of
the Father?
Right. So let's play that out. Okay. So what if I go to Salvington right now, and I walk up, to our Creator Son, and interact with him personally. Right. Now, what exactly is innate within him, because the Universal Father is a parent? Right? It's the deity. It's Father-type deity. Right? But our Creator Son has his own personality. Right? I mean, if you go to him on Salvington right now, you don't see someone who has put his will underneath someone else's will. Not my will, but your will be done. Remember, we shouldn't think that way, but a Creator Son does that, right? He's saying, okay, I'm going to set my will aside, and just manifest one of the seven master spirits' will. Right? But if you go to Salvington right now, no, you get yet another will. You get a will of our Creator Son's personality, which is a will different from the will of the Universal Father, the Eternal Son, the Conjoint Actor, or, any of the other, several hundred thousand Creator Sons, or any of the Ancients of Days. I mean, every one of these beings has their own will, right? They aren't all just
and personality
disappearing and letting it just be the Father. Because, why do we tend to think that? Because of our monotheism and our notion that when all is said and done, the Father is personally present. So really, everything is just the personality of the Father. No, it's the exact opposite of that, right? And they're about to tell you that in relative terms, this secondary Lenanadec, he's not here doing the Father's will. He's here doing his will.
Right.
He's putting that will in cooperative subordination to the environment. But when it comes down to something where, they just, hand it over to him, when it's actually his specific delegated job, he doesn't have to make sure that, is this okay with you or something? No. He's completely sovereign, in that area. And whatever, his will is, You know, they'll mention to you, for instance, the Melchizedek's kind of overseeing this or something. They don't intervene on that. You know, what he wants goes. See, so that, you know, we have to come to terms with this. And that can be scary, right? A monotheism is a religion for the fearful, right? It helps with our fear if we believe that fundamentally there aren't all these wills that can just do their will. You know, if somehow really it is all just the Father's will and it's going to be okay.
But the majority, right, you know? choose to do the right thing. I mean,
Right. But again, we haven't gotten to the majority doing the right thing. You know, we're right in the middle of them saying sometimes, right? They go astray. We're just trying to understand the sometimes, right? Not the norm, right? But the exception and why the exception happens, right? And again, one of the reasons why it can happen is because a Lananadec isn't, you know, when it gets right down to the trenches. They're not in any sort of shackles at all. They don't have to check with any sort of higher-up or something. Now, they are the final authority.
Now we have a real excuse to be a victim.
Right? Right. And so can you not take the other avenue? Right. I mean, it's a great example. I mean, of just going to victim status. You know, when I explain this to you, I'm a helpless victim. You know, why even bother? There's all these wills that aren't properly consecrated and, you know, right, right. You're kind of just back to the, you know, pre-ancient Greece days, you know, where you have a fundamentally animistic sort of worldview where it's not even worth trying to figure out if there's some laws governing, you know, the matter of this cup, because, you know, there could be some spirit being that could just at its whim do whatever at any moment, and, you know, so why even bother trying, you know, looking for laws? There can't be any, because everything's just subject to the whims of the spirits, right? Right. See, notice how there's shades of that. See, when you actually get to it, okay, there's a reason why someone might believe that in ancient times. There's a truth to that notion. Right? There are many wills. There isn't just one will. And you have to eventually trust. Just like Melchizedek might have to trust that secondary Lananadec, what it just chose to do is okay. They're thinking, I don't know, right? No, they've got to trust and let it all play out. Right? Many, 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 many times a Melchizedek might think, I don't know, and there isn't a rebellion that ensues. You know, several hundred thousand years later, they're, you know, in retrospect, they go, whoa, that was cool. See, now, if that creativity of that Lananadec, if I had jumped in and not let that creativity play out, we never would have gotten to that. If we'd used my limited perspective, I mean, we would have been stuck in this rut for 100,000 years or whatever. But I trusted, and I let that creativity manifest, even though at the time I was not too certain about it. Right? The real universe involves trust, because the Father is not personally present in the universe of universes.
But still, we think of him being personally present within each individual.
We think of him being personally present, but he's not, right? He's pre-personally present.
Yeah.
Right. He's not actually personally present. You know, and they, let's see, was it there? Yeah. The Universal Father lives in man by the pre-personal presence of the mystery monitors. We just read that, see? In simplistic terms, you can think that, but see, when you get down to being precise, you notice when they want you to be precise, right?
Makes you start to think about pre-personal.
Right, right. In other words, there's a presence there that you could take a hold of and personalize.
Yeah.
And again, it's like, oh, well, that's really cool. Yeah, well, that potential wouldn't be there if he personally had a hold of that.
Right.
I mean, an adjuster would be completely useless to you if it was him personally present. That means he has complete hold of it and there's nothing there for you. He has to completely let go of it personally, or it's of utterly no use to you. I mean, are you going to elbow the father's personal will out of the way and get a hold of it and do something with it? No. Right? He has to completely be personally hands-off for it to be of any usefulness to you.
And we're of no use to an adjuster if an adjuster's personal.
Yeah. So, right, to just, you know, this is the difference of, you know, the fifth epical revelation fundamentally. Okay, but basically, you know, you've got this downstepping, and when it gets this far downstepped, you've got individuals who are tested severely, just like us. I mean, really, when all is said and done, exactly like us. They face the exact same test that we do between here and leaving Gerasim. Right? They're put down into a local system, just like we're born into a local system. They face the local system test. Right? And most pass, but a few fail. Right? Now, in the specifics of that, you know, back there when they talked about the Lenonidex sons in that earlier paper, says, our local universe has been unfortunate in that over 700 sons of the Lenonidec order have rebelled against the universe government, thus precipitating confusion in several systems and on numerous planets. Right, 'cause there's only three system ones, right? See, so lots of individual planetary rebellions.
In other universes, because we only got 37, right?
Well, no, I mean, no. This is in our local universe, just in our local universe.
What I mean, in our system, we only had 37. There's only been three systems that have rebelled. So if there's 700, one of them had a big.
Right. There's lots and lots. Right. See, I mean, it's not all about those three system rebellions and the handful of worlds that went with them. Right. There's lots and lots of local systems that had individual worlds that rebelled.
Oh, interesting.
See. Right. Again, that's what normally happens, right? I mean, normally planets don't rebel because the system sovereign rebels. That's a very, very exception, right?
It's a whole right. Scale.
Most of the time, the local system is just fine, but one of the planetary princes rebels.
Right.
Okay, hundreds and hundreds of them.
Yeah.
Okay, lots and lots of worlds have been in our boat.
So you get so many mighty messengers.
Okay, and so it says, see, over 700 sons of the Lenonidec order have rebelled against the universe government, thus precipitating confusion in several systems and on numerous planets. Of this entire number of failures, only three were system sovereigns. Practically all of these sons belong to the second and third orders, planetary princes and tertiary Lenonidecs. The large number of these sons who have lapsed from integrity does not indicate any fault in creatorship. I wanted to read this too because we just read about that again. They could have been made divinely perfect, but they were so created that they might better understand and draw near to the evolutionary creatures dwelling on the worlds of time and space. Right? There's no mistake. They're made that way. That's the Father's way, if you want to take it all the way back up to the Father.
Makes perfect sense.
Right?
We could have an archangel. That would be fun.
Yeah, see, that was what I was just pointing out. I mean, you know, the archangels, you know, are basically as removed from us in a local universe as any creature is. Remember, you know, they're the highest of the spirit beings of large numbers, right? So, you know, they're kind of, you know, a secondary Lenonidec functioning as a planetary prince is sort of at the opposite end of the local universe spectrum of celestial beings.
Gradations of
authority. Kind of another reason why you can think, you know, understand them being archangels, right? Let's see. So where were we? We finished.
Chris, there's this line, but not often do these world princes fail.
Yeah, right. Like we just read, there's how many planets in a local universe?
10 million
eventually. and they're saying 700. Okay, right. In percentage wise, it's a very small percentage, But if you're on one of those worlds where the planetary prince rebels, who cares about percentages? Percentages are irrelevant, right?
We're saturated with rebellion.
Yeah, you're not going to go, well, at least it's only 700 out of 10 million, right? That's not going to comfort you.
We have the prince and the system and the
animal. Right. Okay.
Pacifier there.
Okay, so before Katie reads that last paragraph of section one here, just, you know, remind yourself of that, the rest of that sentence about the Father not being personally present, you know, so also imposes a certain test of faith and loyalty on all these sons and as well as you, right? That initial bit of using your faith grasp to take a hold of that other fact in that initial domain that you're created in, you know, the Father. But what you take a hold of that faith grasp is not something you're going to see. Right? You're going to vaguely feel that you're holding on to something. You know, and then you just have to trust and remain loyal to that which, you know, you can't really see. But hopefully with time, feels more and more solid, you know, in your faith grasp fingers. Right? But again, you're not going to get away from this abstraction aspect of it until you're on the third circuit of Avona and take that trip to the Isle of Paradise and experience the Father personally for the first time.
Yeah.
Right? It's not until the third circuit of Avona that you get that first personal experience with the Father, you know, in a direct way. Any other time that you talk about his personality circuit and, you know, think of a personal connection, it's not direct. It's a very indirect, very tenuous thing, right? Until the third circuit of Avona, a long time from now, right? Until then, you need to trust that this very complicated system that you're existing in, that comes from the God the Sevenfold, is all the way it's supposed to be when all is said and done, despite all appearances to the contrary, right? Like Jesus said, I know no real harm can befall me, you know, despite all appearances to the contrary. Don't expect to not have those appearances to the contrary, right? you don't get that luxury, you know. There are no appearances to the contrary in Havona, but there's nothing but appearances to the contrary out here. Yep. You had something, Joan?
Yeah, but it seems that Jesus always encouraged not only the apostles, but whoever he was in contact with to seek the Father's will.
Yes, yeah, you definitely want
to
seek
their own personal will.
Right, you know, and remember with us, you know, it's the positive consecration. It is my will that your will be done. You know, and so in this context that we've been going through, you know, just appreciate what Jesus was trying to get you to do. He was trying to get you to do step one, to really initiate yourself with the initiator. Right? But Jesus didn't come to show us the last step. He came to show us the very first step. Choose to be initiated by the initiator. And at the same time he said to seek the Father's will, he kept trying to pound into them. Now, we're not talking about your material father here. Right? God is your spiritual father. You're not going to see him. You're not going to find him in the outer life. Don't go on some quest to some location on the planet. You know, don't go on some elaborate, you know, don't go into some elaborate process where you try to rearrange the molecules in your temple until the Father is present, right? He's not to be found in the outer life. He's your spiritual Father. And he's only to be found in the depths, the core of your inner life. Right? Did the apostles get that? Nope, not an iota. They never could get that. Way too abstract, you know? So they continued in the mode humans have always been in, looking for the Father in the outer life, you know, and fixating on rearranging the molecules in the outer life to improve their relationship to the Father, You know, get the right incense, the right lighting, right, the right statues, you know, whatever the heck it is.
Incantation.
Right? No. He's not your material father.
Incense.
Right? He's your spiritual father. Right? But even the greatest philosophers that have lived haven't been able to appreciate the fact that spirit is a third fact. Even the greatest minds, that's been too abstract for them. So no wonder it was too abstract for fishermen in 2,000 years ago, right? Philosophers have barely been able to hold on to mind being separate from matter, so that there's two things, let alone a third thing that's even more abstract, right? It's what you're taking a hold of with that faith grasp has no immediacy to it, right? It's very removed from anything that's going to be tangible in the normal sense of that word to you, right? So you have to be loyal to that which you, you know, you can't really sink your fingers into and squeeze and be certain of, yep, definitely, this arm of this couch is here. I can shake it and, okay, yeah, I can be loyal to this couch. I don't have to sit here and panic that the thing is going to collapse on me. I'm pretty sure it's solid. You don't get that with the Father, right? Okay. All right, so we don't need to belabor that, but just find that, you know, challenge yourself to find the courage to let go of that initial crutch of monotheism and get into the complexities here that they're talking about. Okay.
But not often do these world princes fail in their missions of organizing and administering the inhabited spheres, and their success greatly facilitates the subsequent missions of the material sons, who come to engraft the higher forms of creature life on the primitive men of the worlds. Their rule also does much to prepare the planets for the paradise sons of God, who subsequently come to judge the worlds and to inaugurate successive dispensations.
Yeah, okay. We all know that's pretty basic stuff, you know. But of course, you can't help but think about the contrast there. And their success greatly facilitates the subsequent missions of the material sons, or the opposite. Yeah, their failure. Yeah, we've talked about that. I mean, you wonder if it's even possible for an Adam and Eve to be successful if the planetary prince rebels. I mean, it's got to be a really small percentage, you would think, of material sons and daughters who have ever been successful in the wake of a rebellion of the prince on that world. So, I mean, obviously, if you get some special thing where, you know, like Michael on one of his bestowals, if he cleans up the planetary prince situation, okay, then the material son and daughter are going to be okay. But, you know, barring an intervention like that, I mean, that's why, you know, when our Adam and Eve were sent here, you know, the percentage chance of, you know, of them being successful is so small, you know, it's too many zeros to even, you know, 0.00000000001%, right? I mean, and you could see that, how they didn't even make it through the first night. Right? They didn't make it 24 hours and they were already down on the slippery slope. Right? I mean, you know, they just mentioned this, you know, being quite alone as representatives. It's difficult even for a secondary Lenonendek to be alone and maintain his integrity. Yeah, it's basically impossible for a material son and daughter to be alone and maintain their integrity. Right? Like we saw with ours, they didn't even last 24 hours, and they were already slipping. Yeah, so, I mean, it was just inertia that carried him 100 years.
What happened in that first 24 hours?
Well, just if you remember how that first night, you know, as they were sitting alone, you know, our Adam and Eve, and they were so alone.
So lonely.
Right? They point out that very first thing, it was just, if it felt like they were in an infinite black space, you know, they felt they were so alone. You go, okay, writing's on the wall, right? It's just the way they tell you how they felt that first night. Yeah, it was all over but the crying. And they needed to be alone that first night and yet know that they're not alone. Right? Like, you need to know that. Are you ever alone? No. Not even remote. You have a fragment of infinity inside of you. What's the definition of alone in that context? How do you escape infinity to be alone? I mean, it's just ludicrous for us to think that we're alone. We're the farthest removed from alone. Okay, now Adam and Eve don't have an adjuster, okay? It's a little easier to understand. But you know, you know, for them to already be losing their grip on things when they couldn't reach out and touch the shiny crystals on Gerizim.
Almost feel sorry.
Right? Right?
Yeah, really.
Yeah. When all the gilded doors and were around them all the time, it was easy to stay integrous. But the moment there's nothing but dirt clods and darkness, poof. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Where it says, who subsequently come to judge the worlds, the paradise sons of God. Mm-hmm. Okay, they don't come to judge the individuals. They're coming to judge. But what do you suppose they mean, judge the worlds? Because it's already, they don't come except at the end of an age. Right. What's the judgment?
Right, I mean, there's a, you know, an adjudication at the end of each dispensation. That's the quote-unquote judging. It's just simply that worldwide, judgment of all the individuals. And you can also think in terms of that, that assessment, that judging, is those things they don't talk about, those very mysterious issues of ending a dispensation and beginning a new one, that go beyond the individuals involved. You know, remember, each dispensation is a whole new environment. I mean, all the laws on the world change from one dispensation to the next. The laws, the unseen laws, as it were. You know, the way mind functions on that world. You know, we were just talking about that in the previous paper, remember?
We talked about that last time.
Yeah, right. See, so there's, you know, they're judging the transition from one environment to the next, too, as it were, right? I mean, they're overseeing that whole transition of the norms.
So the individuals are being judged, but they're...
The living and the dead.
But the judgment for one dispensation of the rules or the laws that they're living under would be different than the next.
That judgment is relative to the dispensation. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. All right, so that's why I was bringing in the whole dispensation thing. Because you want to all, you know, again, because of our bias to the Father, we tend to forget about the environment is equally important. Right? I mean, our historical thinking is so Father-biased that there really isn't an environment. There's just us individuals, you know, and the Father, or God, you know, and if you ask someone that's purely in that mode, like, why are there stars in the sky? Well, they say, well, so that I have something pretty to look at night. I mean, the only rationalization they have for the universe, you know, is it revolves around you. The stars exist, so, you know, to revolve around you. And see, it's a very, hyper-individualistic worldview because it's so Father-biased. Right? And so, a lot of things like what I've just been stressing. Okay. All right, let's get into the planetary administration here a little bit.
Number two, planetary administration. All planetary princes are under the universe administrative jurisdiction of Gabriel, the chief executive of Michael. While in immediate authority, they are subject to the executive mandates of the system sovereigns.
So why did they stick that little bit right up front there? I mean, day to day, it's just the planetary princes are under the system sovereign. But the fallback administrative authority, is Gabriel, you know, no matter what there, you know, why there might be a need for a fallback. Right? And obviously, if the system sovereign rebels, along with the planetary prince, right, it definitely goes back to the fallback. I mean, that's why Gabriel, you know, is here, eventually putting forward the ideas of God the Sevenfold in contrast to Lucifer holding forth. And just that is another challenge. Right? It's not Michael here. Certainly not the Universal Father, right? Like some kind of anthropomorphic Lucifer rebellion story might be. Right? I mean, Michael doesn't get into those sorts of details. That's Gabriel's job. Right? And so, you know, notice the tendency that, you know, that you may have had, or others, you know, that read the book might have had to. You know, instead of putting everything on one God, one monotheistic God, you allow for Michael in the picture, and a lot of times you end up kind of dumping most of the immediate things that you used to dump on your monotheistic God onto Michael, and that's not valid either. I mean, he has limited jobs. I mean, you know, remember eventually when these local universes settle in light and life, he doesn't even show up that often anymore. I mean, that really, see, there's that, when it's factualized like that, when the local universe is settled in light and life, that tells you what kind of a truth is in play long before that fact, right? The truth is, right now, that he's in many ways kind of as aloof as the Universal Father is. He's not what you're looking for either, as that intimate person when you're fearful, you know, that has a hold of all the strings. He's not the answer either. Right? You know, he doesn't even pull the strings of the Spirit of Truth. If he did, he couldn't leave the local universe.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Just see again. Just notice. You know that. And from coming from a monotheistic place, that could be scary stuff. Right. I mean, you might start to feel quite fearful. About, you know, you start to look over your shoulder to make sure that the boogeyman isn't coming to get you, right? You know, you got to trust, right? If Michael or the Universal Father, you know, was the ultimate puppet master and had a hold of a string on every automaton, what would you need trust for?
Right. Just call the water boy.
Right? No, you need to trust. That things work out. Not because there's a string on every part. There aren't strings on the parts. The integrity you're looking for is because those parts aren't just parts. This distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other, by puppet strings or otherwise, right? Except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. The integrity you're looking for is not the ultimate puppet master of all the parts. There's a whole. The parts can't help but work together in a system because they're part of a whole. It isn't the magic of part manipulation that makes life bearable. It's the integrity of the whole. I maintain my sanity not because the Universal Father puppets the parts of my mind every second. I maintain my sanity because it's innate in the integrity of the whole, of which it's a part. Right? Yeah. And that should help you to, you know, to get over the fear, to do that step one like Jesus said, you know. Why did he, you know, have no real fear despite all appearances of the contrary? Because he knew it wasn't, it appears to be nothing but parts hanging in empty space. But it's not really. It's a whole, and there are no spaces. Find a gap in the local universe where she's not present. There is no such place. Right? There is no such place. She's ubiquitous. Right? The parts don't need to be held up by puppet strings. She's underneath, right? All of those parts, as a whole, they aren't really parts like you think. They're sort of just bumps on the whole, right? There is just one fact. Right? Her ubiquity. All right. Okay. So. Okay, we've kind of gotten through all those. They front load all this. You notice how they just keep all these little details they keep putting up front because they want us to finally get it into a space where.
What you're saying makes it easier to trust. I think. You
know, yes, it should, right?
It absolutely should.
Because at the same time that you lose the magic puppeteer, the father that you've always assuaged your fears with, you gain something real. Right? It holds together as a system not because of incredible puppeteering. It's because it's a whole. Right? You have another parent. Right? Your fears are assuaged by the recognition of the other parent. Right? And through her, you can finally evolve your faith into trust. Okay.
The planetary princes may at any time seek the counsel of the Melchizedeks, their former instructors and sponsors, but they are not arbitrarily required to ask for such assistance. And if such aid is not voluntarily requested, the Melchizedeks do not interfere with the planetary administration. These world rulers may also avail themselves of the advice of the 24 counselors assembled from the bestowal worlds of the system. In Satania, these counselors are at present all natives of Urantia, and there is an analogous council of 70 at the constellation headquarters, also selected from the evolutionary beings of the realms.
Okay, so they've got all this potential help, but notice how they slipped in there. But they don't have to ask for any of that help. Right? Because there's a whole bunch of things that they don't need any permission for. They can just do whatever. However their will moves them. Right? I told you they were going to bring that up here.
They don't ask for help, they don't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Melchizedek sits there.
Yep. Right, the Melchizedeks are not going to poke their fingers into it. The Melchizedeks do not interfere with the planetary administration. Yeah. Doesn't matter how much wiser that Melchizedek appears to be to himself as he watches what the Lenonadec is doing. Right, he knows that he has to trust the integrity of the whole. He can't see himself as the puppeteer either. And try to puppet all the parts, right? Okay. See, and that's where it's, you know, they're bringing it down to us. That's where you should start to recognize how this is immediately relevant to you, right? Notice that if you have any spiritual consciousness, the moment you have a recognition of ideals, with any definitives, your first instinct is to become a puppeteer and to try to puppet the parts of the world.
Well, you should try to do stuff for your own self.
Right.
You should try to improve yourself.
Right, so what's the balance? Oh my goodness, what is the balance? Where do I find the wisdom to figure out what the balance is between sticking my nose into something and letting it be? I mean, the answer is not one or the other, or you have your nose in everything, or you have your nose in nothing. Right? There's no dichotomy here of simplicity. Right? But see, there. What are they? They're trying to bias you. Notice, you know, and I'm trying to, in what I'm saying, I'm trying to bias you, and that's why you feel a little bit of a reaction, right? Your spiritual consciousness has an instinct. It doesn't like what I'm saying, right? Lucifer didn't like what I'm saying. He wanted to become the puppeteer. And just, can't we just puppet things into light and life? Right? No. You need to trust the evolutionary process. It's like, well, we send planetary princes. Isn't that like sticking our nose into other people's business? Yes. Well, which is it? Well, there's some wise balance. Some things, when you stick your nose into other people's business, is conforms to the supreme. Other times, you're in rebellion. Yeah, and there's no in between. It's either okay or totally not okay.
But you get better at it.
Right, but you get better at it. That which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. You're not expected to be perfect at this. But they're trying to get you biased. They're trying to temper your spiritual consciousness. Right? You need some material pragmatism to go with that spiritual idealism. Because the two together is wisdom. Right? And all kinds of spiritually conscious people on this planet don't have that balance and are getting very excited about, like, nation building. Right? Yeah, and you know, that's, and this is not a left or right thing, you know, independent of so-called left or right politically. Notice there's a growing desire to fix parts of the world, build them into light and life. Right, that's because we don't have tempered perspective. Right, that's why this book is in my lap, because our spiritual consciousness is running away with no tempering. It's unbridled spiritual consciousness. It thinks it's innately divine. It thinks it knows how to puppet the parts. You know, if the Father isn't going to step in and puppet the parts, well, I should then. Right? You know, and a politician will say, elect me. I'm the grand master puppeteer. I will puppet the parts and we will have light and life. And your spiritual consciousness says yes and votes for them. Right? Right. Does your spiritual consciousness want to hear someone say, well, you know, you just basically need to step back and just let the evolutionary process play out? No. You're not going to vote for that. We show a surprising willingness, the relatives say, to dismiss that out of hand, that thought. Right?
But as you said a minute ago, there's a happy medium.
Right. How do you find that? You know, well, I mean, you're not going to find it at all if you never challenge yourself, you know, to go through the difficult process of figuring out when you should intervene in something and when you shouldn't, when it's wise and when it's not. I mean, this is not easy. Even Melchizedek's fail in this. Sometimes Melchizedek's think they should intervene in something and they get called up.
Yeah, does it bring God, you know? God closer to man?
Or right? I mean, this is not easy stuff. Melchizedek's even fail at this occasionally. Right? And they're a lot wiser than I am, or any of us. Right? Right? But they are seeking that balance, and they know that most, they should probably start with humility. Probably shouldn't start with pride. Probably should start with humility. And never intervene is your initial assumption. And only very occasionally, when you think you really have encompassed a vast scope and have the requisite wisdom, okay, I think maybe here I'll give it a try. Pooh, I fall flat on my face. Okay, I wasn't as wise as I thought. That which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. It's not going to be held against you. The important thing is you are trying to be humble and only, you know, muck with the evolutionary process when you thought you could synchronize with it appropriately. But to think there is no evolutionary process, right? You know, 20th century, 21st century man, most of us will acknowledge a biologic evolutionary process, but show me some spiritual idealist, I shouldn't say spiritual idealist, some idealist, you know, who acknowledges the full evolutionary nature of mind and spirit, right? No, they don't think spirit needs any evolutionary process, and it's innately divine, and you just need to apply it. No. No, everything's evolutionary. So, this is all very relevant. And I'm stressing this because we're building up to this. I mean, it's one of the most important sections in the book about this that we're coming up to in this paper, about the developmental epochs. Right? Very, 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 very challenging to your spiritual consciousness. Not what you're wanting to hear. Not what you're wanting to hear from a fifth epical revelation. Not what you think is good news. Okay? All right. Yep.
The rule of the evolutionary planets in their early and unsettled careers is largely autocratic. The planetary princes organized their specialized groups of assistants from among their corps of planetary aides. They usually surround themselves with a supreme council of 12, but this is variously chosen and diversely constituted on the different worlds. A planetary prince may also have as assistants one or more of the third order of his own group of sonship, and sometimes on certain worlds, one of his own order, a secondary Ladonadec associate.
Right, so that sounds familiar, right? We know we got one of his own order. We had Dalagastia as well as Caligastia, two secondary Ladonadec. So we're one of those exceptional worlds that way. And we've talked about, it's also very, very likely, we at least had one of the third order, most likely Abaddon, is a tertiary Ladonadec, right? That chief of staff. So I think we probably had one of each. There's no sign that we had more, but
we had three governing Ladonadecs.
Well, we had two secondaries and a tertiary.
Okay,
right? Tertiary. Right? I mean, you don't know for certain, but that's the most likely who that chief of staff is. You know, who Abaddon is. He's not. I mean, normally the core, the core of the celestial staff, separate from the corporeal staff, are seraphim, administrator seraphim. I remember how we read about those administrator seraphim working with the planetary princes and along with the system sovereigns there a while back, in that paper. But occasionally, you've got other celestials that maybe of a little bit higher nature, right? And so that's my guess. Abaddon. The chief of staff.
Still here.
He comes up later.
Yeah, he comes up later, yeah. When they talk about the rebellion. Let's see. So those details, you can see how we're kind of, just kind of the fact we're a decimal world, we were in that same mode of kind of being the exception to a lot of the rules, right? You can see that. We had all this potential for these not often actualized potentials to actualize here. We were kind of out on the frontiers of potential space, right? And it all fell off the edge.
And remember our planetary prince, he wanted a world that was a decimal world.
All of it, this whole excitement of all these possibilities that normally aren't in play, right? These opportunities for creativity that normally don't exist. But you give someone that much potential for creativity, you give them just that much potential for destructivity. Okay. just one passing stressing of it, largely autocratic. Right? See, like I was saying, right? I mean, largely, they don't have to look to anyone. Is this okay? They're the autocrat.
Enjoy.
What they say is the way it is. Right? They're given a lot of free rein.
So they'd be easy to beguile somebody.
Yeah. Right. And so because they have that free reign, I mean, if they snap, all the celestials on the planet jump. Yeah. Right. The celestials, their first instinct isn't to look to someone. It's like, well, is that order okay? No, the autocrat, you just follow what the autocrat says.
Yes, right. Sir.
All right.
The entire staff of a world ruler consists of personalities of the infinite spirit and certain types of higher evolved beings and ascending mortals from other worlds. Such a staff averages about 1,000, and as the planet progresses, this core of helpers may be increased up to 100,000 or more. At any time need is felt for more helpers, the planetary princes have only to make request of their brothers, the system sovereigns, and the petition is granted forthwith.
So not only do they have access to all those, advice givers, like they're talking about, but direct assistance too. I mean, you know, basically without limit. If Cal Gashu is feeling like he, things are getting too complicated, he could have just, you know, asked for however many helpers, you know, and he would have gotten them forthwith. Right? So,
especially seeing as he was in league with the Tsar.
Right. So it's just, you know, the only time, you know, they're just trying to stress that the only way that things can go astray is if this individual in that initial space we all start in starts to believe, you know, I think I actually am an island universe. You know, I'm a completeness unto myself. Right? That's the problem. Right? But, you know, it's not for lack of potential assistance. You know, this quite alone thing, you know, is not a, you know, a death sentence. Okay, so all right, so like, you know, notice how they mentioned, you know, by and large, you're dealing, you know, with personalities of the infant spirit, like seraphim. You know, most of the staff are those kind of beings, with a few others sprinkled in. And you can tell there's probably a bunch of unrevealed beings that are occasionally involved, higher evolved beings. You don't know who in the heck they're talking about there, really. And of course, ascending mortals, that's the corporeal staff that we're going to get to here. Okay?
Planets vary greatly in nature and organization and in administration, but all provide for tribunals of justice. The judicial system of the local universe has its beginnings in the tribunals of the planetary prince, which are presided over by a member of his personal staff. The decrees of such courts reflect the highly fatherly and discretionary attitude. All problems involving more than the regulation of the planetary inhabitants are subject to appeal to the higher tribunals, but the affairs of his world domain are largely adjusted in accordance with the personal discretion of the prince.
Okay, so again, just reminding you of that autocrat, but notice it's, you know, he's really fully like that only when it deals with the mortals. And then notice that highly fatherly and discretionary attitude. In contrast, all that stressing about the son they did up front. What do they mean there? Notice that fatherly is not capitalized. Yeah, also. The discretionary attitude, trying to get you, you know, it's this intervention into, right? There's place, and then there's injection into that place. There's intervention into that place. You know, is it a motherly attitude where you're the individuality of the whole, right? Or is it a fatherly attitude where you're outside, you know, and are poking your finger in? Right, that's what they're pointing out. So that just, that fiat from without attitude, right? That's what they're speaking to there. You know, so that makes for an interesting contrast, you know, to what I was just saying about, you know, trying to mitigate that tendency to do that all the time, want to constantly poke your finger in, you know, and letting the whole play out more. So you see the challenge that the planetary prince has. He has to really, I mean, since he's supposed to poke his finger into things, you know, quite a bit, it's up to him to acquire the big picture perspective so that when he does that, he does it well, or even not rebelliously, right? He isn't innately given that ability, just like we aren't innately given that ability, to always poke our fingers into things wisely. He just has to go about it experientially. So again, he needs to start very, very humble, right? It's like, well, how about this little thing? Okay, that seemed to go okay, right? Yeah, and the moment he doesn't behave like that, the moment he thinks, oh, forget about the baby steps, let's just go for it, right? Then there's going to be problems, right? And that's that unbridled zeal that humans always have. You know, I don't want to wait for a 5-year plan, let's do it tomorrow, right? Your spiritual consciousness hates time, does not know anything about time, right? You know, is the catalyst of impatience, right? The beginning of destruction. For rebellion or default, right? It all begins with impatience, right? And it's not your material consciousness is innately patient. It's your spiritual consciousness that's impatient, right? That's how problematic it is. It's the beginning of problem, right? If you don't have spiritual consciousness, there's not going to be any problem, right? So again, everyone thinking that has some spiritual consciousness thinking the problem is people who lack spiritual consciousness. No, that's not the problem. The real problem is you, potentially, if you have spiritual consciousness and your lack of humility that you're likely to have. You know, and thinking you should make lots of plans for other personalities. Lots and lots of plans, because boy, do you see the big picture. And it's going to be really good. So everyone will just listen to me, damn it. Right? Right? Okay. Let's see. So, yeah. Okay. So anyway, so the petition would be granted forthwith. If he needed 100,000 helpers, he'd get 100,000 helpers.
The roving
commission. No, planets.
That was right. We just read the red planets.
And we did. Oh, we did. Okay. I'm sorry. That's right. I flipped back the page because I was reading that. I'm sorry. Okay. So hold on. I got to check to make sure. That was a paragraph off. Make sure I've said it and everything there. Right, you got the judicial, right, okay. Yeah, okay, they're going to give you the rest on that in the next paragraph. Right, you've got this basic sort of judicial system that's very local, and then the contrast of that is this.
The roving commissions of conciliators serve and supplement the planetary tribunals, and both spirit and physical controllers are subject to the findings of these conciliators. But no arbitrary execution is ever carried out without the consent of the Constellation Father, for the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men.
Okay, I've pointed to this before. This is one of those very few spots where they mention that whole other set of controllers that they don't basically talk about. I mean, you know, they give you lots about the physical controllers, right? But they basically aren't allowed to tell you about the whole parallel set. You know, but they do mention them here, the spirit controllers. Right? There's a whole bunch of beings that are, like we talked about, that are involved with handling that other substance, just like the physical controllers handle material substance, or material energy. You know, and this ominous thing that when you think about just how inscrutable the acts of the conciliators, you know, and the executioner can be sometimes, even for the revelators, you know, don't just picture some incredible changing of the arrangement of material molecules like you've never imagined would be allowable. Spirit substance is in play too, right? Yeah, those controllers, spirit and physical, if the divine executioner says, blow it all up, they blow it all up. There's no qualification, you know, possibly. I mean, that's why they tell you back there when they're talking about the conciliators that sometimes they do things that even the relatives go, wow, really? That's okay, huh?
Yeah, I'm so glad I moved.
All 100 trumpets need to be blown? Yeah. Right? So sometimes if really drastic measures are needed, sky's the limit. No telling what they could do. So if that sounds a little scary, you need to find some courage.
And trust.
And trust. Even if the trumpets blast, it's going to be okay in the end, right? No real harm can befall you, right? Right? If there's real harm done to you, you've done that to yourself. No one else can do real harm to you. Right? Death is not real harm. That's just actual harm. No real harm can befall you unless you so will it. But you've got the Most Highs, right? So that little reminder that you know, that they're the lid on all the potential issues here. Yeah. Right? You've got all this potential loosey-goosey down in the local system. Right? But above that is the integrity of the constellation. You know, you're reminded of that integrity when you think about the Trinity individual that's there with the Verondex. You know, what's the name of those of days ones that are down there at the constellation level? Faithfuls of days. Faithful, right? You know, so if there is if there is this issue with a certain test of faith and loyalty and all these things, right? If there's a faith issue, no, there's a faithful level above that. Most eyes rule in the kingdoms of men.
That must cause some chafing for Lenonidex, who are used to having a lot of latitude.
Right. So, you know, that foreign potentate thing, you know, they know that, you know, usually the ancients of days don't directly poke their nose into something, right? Their deputies effectively do, the Verondex, mm-hmm. right? The Most Highs. You know, and it's especially grating when it's like, I mean, the Verondex are just my brothers. You know, why am I subservient to them? Right. You know, why do mom and dad love them more than me? Right? Yeah, you know, you can see how you can anthropomorphically play this out. Right?
Okay. It's not more, it's just different.
Yeah. That's a singular paragraph that gives you that direct statement about the spirit controllers.
See that very often.
No, it's just alluded to, I think, just one other time. But here it's, you know, they actually put it right there in black and white. But of course, you notice that they didn't say physical and spirit controllers. They even sort of hid it by, you know, putting them in that order. But so you can't search for spirit controller and find it.
Are the physical controllers the master?
The master physical controllers, yeah. And there's a whole group of beings like them for spirit's energy.
In my mind, I've got these master physical controllers as being incapable of wrong.
Well, they're not saying.
And here they said, no, they're subject to judgment.
No. The findings of the conciliators, you know, to execute their, you know, the mandates of those conciliators, the spirit and physical controllers will obey them.
Like they cut us off, that kind of thing.
Oh, so rather than the planetary.
They're not the bad guys.
They're not the bad guys. They're not being judged. They are the means of judgment.
Oh, okay.
They execute
them. You've been judged.
So the planetary prince has to just.
Right. So, you know, they're reminding you, you know. If matter needs to get unraveled, physical controllers can do that. Spirit substance needs to get unraveled, that can be done too. Because you got a spirit body, you're not going to survive the fire.
Okay.
We'll unravel it all. All right.
The controllers and transformers of planetary assignment are also able to collaborate with angels and other orders of celestial beings in rendering these later personalities.
These latter
personalities visible to mortal creatures. On special occasions, the seraphic helpers and even the Melchizedeks can and do make themselves visible to the inhabitants of the evolutionary worlds. The principal reason for bringing mortal ascenders from the system capital are, as a part of the staff of the planetary prince, is to facilitate communication with the inhabitants of the realm.
Okay. Well, we really don't have time to go into the next section, so let's talk this out some more here. This whole issue of you know, the physical controllers being there. Now they're mentioning the controllers and the transformers, you know, so the mechanical controllers and the energy transformers, kind of giving you the kind of the point individuals, you know, involved amongst the, all of the master physical controllers. Right, you know, we talk about this a lot. When you this whole issue, if a seraphim or some other angel is going to be visible to someone, they can't do that of their own nature, right? They've got to get the master physical controllers to make them physically visible, to give them some kind of a, you know, avatar sort of coding, right? You know, some sort of physical energy associated with their body, you know, that produces a representation of their invisible body that's visible, right? In the same way they were making Jesus's Maranja body visible, right? That, you know, these same beings were doing the exact same thing, effectively, that they do with an angel.
Did that to Gabriel when he appeared to Mary, you think?
Right, right. You know, Gabriel, Father Melchizedek, you know, on the Mount of Transfiguration, right? Gabriel to Mary, right? To Elizabeth, you know, same thing. Right, so, yeah, it's the master physical controllers, and like they're giving specifically the controllers and the transformers here that, you know, do whatever it is that they do to produce some kind of a, you know, we'd probably think of it like effectively like a skin, you know, sort of a physical skin that conforms to their you know, non-corporeal body and produces a corporeal expression, you know, appearance anyway, you know. I mean, but their inner nature is unchanged. Whereas with, you know, when they talk about Melchizedek, remember, that's different. Right, he isn't just taking on a skin. I mean, he literally, his whole body down to the core, he has control over, he can manifest material if he wants, right? Like they do, like we talked about, if they're going to be a material life, a Melchizedek life carrier, right? I mean, they're, or like when they, when you have the first magisterial son that comes to a world, and he has the 12 Melchizedeks that are his attendants. That magisterial son comes corporeally, and so all 12 Melchizedeks come corporeally. You know, they're not incarnated.
Did Mantusha do that, or was he just incarnated?
What was that?
Did Mantusha do that? Is he, when he appeared here?
Machaventa was incarnated.
He was incarnated.
Right, that was different. That's a very rare thing that they incarnate like that. But it's... it's quite common that they just, they can dial their energy nature and just make it material like we think, you know, material is. It's all mysterious to us, obviously, but, you know.
Now, the secondary midwares don't have to rely upon this.
Yeah, and the secondary midwares also don't have to rely. But, of course, relative to the Melchizedeks, they have a very, they have a knob with only a little bit of movement. Yeah. They can move it from... you know, their nature that's just removed from physical, like we think of it, to physical, you know, just over that little range of the spectrum. Whereas a Melchizedek has this great, you know, range over which they can, you know, if they want to manifest their energy system so that it manifests like a seraphim energy system, they can, you know, or they can really morph how their energy system manifests. And like we've said many times, it's that fact about the Melchizedeks that really gets you to recognize that in a certain way, a local universe just has one type of creature, many different expressions. The fact that you've got a Melchizedek, you can really kind of morph, and it's like, you know, and it's not becoming a different creature. It's just one creature, and now it's manifesting like a seraphim, now it's manifesting like me, now it's manifesting, right? Right, it's just that reminder that in some way, when we think about seraphim, you know, we think about some sort of amorphous glowing energy or something. It's like, no, they've got a body that has veins and, you know, and ductwork, you know, because, I mean, they can just morph it and then it's, It's got all my plumbing. You know, that plumbing doesn't come out of nowhere. Somehow, they already have all of that. I mean, they already have somatic cells with a nucleus, with DNA and, you know, and RNA and the whole machinery thing and mitochondria. And I mean, somehow all of that is effectively there in them and, you know, can be expressed in different ways. It's obviously very mysterious to think about. Yeah. That's just so different than fuzzy, amorphous, you know, pictures of spirit beings like we like to paint, right? I mean, it's like, no, I mean, they literally have, you know, a boundary of a body like my skin forms a boundary. And, I mean, you know, even things like hair and stuff you think about, it's like, right? I mean, that all has to be there somehow, you know? And these beings, if these beings are made manifest, you know, they aren't, you know, they don't manifest without hair and eyebrows and stuff, right? I mean, so, you know, it's really wild to think about. You know, right down to the nitty-gritty, like we talked about with the Melchizedek life carriers. I mean, they have sex with material daughters and procreate babies. I mean, they've got all of the, you know, everything there. It's just amazing to think about, you know, what a spirit being is relative to the way we've always thought about them. Let's see, what else do we have there? Got a couple more minutes here.
Or we could leave early.
We'll wrap up here. Okay, so, you know, again, this last thing about the principal reason for bringing mortal ascenders, you know, from the system capital, you know, that's obviously what we're going to read about next, the corporeal staff, is all this stuff we've been talking about. Okay, you can do all this stuff. You can get master physical controllers to make angels manifest, and, you know, and you can have beings that can modify themselves, yada, yada, yada. But that's all a rigmarole, right? We don't want to think that that's somehow some trivial thing to do. It's a big to-do, apparently. And so the normal solution to this problem is not to make all of those angels that are normally the staff of a prince physically manifest so they can interact with humans. They actually have a corporeal staff. All right, so there's this sort of facing the facts of the laws of nature. And again, it's, think about how that challenges kind of the basic worldview that swirls around our monotheism. You know, in our typical monotheistic worldview, God is the magic man. And everything that goes on relative to that nucleus of the magic man is basically magical in that worldview, right? And so, you know, if you think you had an experience, for instance, where you interacted with an angel that was visible,
don't tell me.
In the typical worldview, you wouldn't think, you know, you would never get, you know, you'd never try to challenge yourself with the science and the physics of that, right? You just, oh, well, you know, I mean, if, you know, the magic man wants to wave his magic wand, you know, poof, you know, an angel is visible to me, you know, and it's just no big deal. No, there isn't any universe like that where, you know, nothing is no big deal. I mean, you get the sense that even for a Melchizedek to morph himself into some other energy expression, this is some great exertion that involves some sort of, you know, great effort of some sort. They don't just say, well, why do we need any other beings besides Melchizedek? See, Melchizedek can do all this sort of stuff, right? No, you've got lesser angels, and you've got primary midwayers, and you've got secondary midwayers, and you have all these beings where it's much more immediate for them to do these jobs, right? And that's because there is no magic. So, you know, that's another part of this whole worldview we've been talking about here, of going beyond the monotheism and bringing in the hierarchy, bringing in all the different beings, is recognizing that there's laws that govern everything, and you can't just sweep all the details away with a magic wand. You know, they all have to face these facts, and coincidentally, there certain jobs need certain kinds of energy body beings. There are certain jobs that need certain energy body beings, and coincidentally, there are beings with that kind of an energy body, right? Right. That's why there are all these different types of beings with all kinds of different types of energy bodies, because there's all kinds of different jobs, and not anyone can do those jobs. Some of them can do it with an effort, but it's much easier for someone that's kind of tailored to that to do that, to allow for that law-dominated universe like that too. At the same time, you let go of the monotheism, let go of the magic as well. Yep.
Well, this thing about the spirit and the physical has kind of got my imagination going. I'm thinking it's quite possible that we may build an imposing structure, say a temple or a government, a place of government. Okay, we see the physical, but it's quite possible that beings could incorporate spirit substance in that building that we can't see, but we may respond. When we walk into that building, it lifts us up because of that spirit nature. There's a spirit nature to the building that we may not recognize, but that's there.
Right, intriguing speculation. Right?
And possibly there might come a time when they decide, well, this isn't serving the function it should be anymore, so they could just remove that spirit nature from that building.
Uh-huh.
It just becomes another structure.
Yeah, so for those of you in the webinar, if you couldn't pick up all that, he's bringing in this, you know, as soon as you start to recognize that there's an awful lot to this planet that doesn't meet the eye, and that you literally have just as many beings on this planet that are doing stuff with spirit substance as you have master physical controllers doing stuff with material energy, your imagination starts to really run wild. It's like, well, wow, I mean, what is all this spirit energy up to? Yeah, and if you couldn't hear it, he was bringing in the interesting speculation of wondering if you have a building that might be sort of reinforced or doubled with spirit substance to add a quality that we would respond to. You know, maybe it's not totally delusional that we build a temple, and it's more than a material structure. Yeah, I can't say that for certain. You know, obviously, we'd love to exalt things like this and imagine that, you know, if we build it, they'll follow in suit. You know, if we want it to be sacred, they'll validate that by adding spirit energy to the building. But you know, just there must be some truth to that, because I mean, setting our role aside, there has to be all kinds of spirit structures on this planet. Just in and of themselves, you know, with no material counterpart at all.
There's an archangel headquarters somewhere.
Right. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff on this planet, you know, of a non-material nature, right? And that gets you into things about, like, if you have a building made out of spirit substance and you plop it on this planet, I mean, why does it sit on the surface? Why doesn't it just like fall through the earth or something? I mean, how does it even know the earth is here? Right, we've talked about that. This whole issue of, it's not just a question of, you know, you're not supposed to think of angels as floating on the planet, you know, around on the planet. They walk on the planet. Right? I mean, if someone describes seeing an angel, do they float towards them? No, they walk towards them, right? Right, so this whole question about the relationship between physical energy and spirit energy is deeply mysterious. I mean, you not only have to have beings, quote-unquote spirit beings that can be stationed on the planet. But you have to have be able to have spirit structures that are on the planet. I mean, when you get to Light and Life and they build that Marantia temple, that sits on the ground. Right? You know, think about it. It's like, well, how does that work? No one can try to push against me and go, wait a minute, what's this object? Oh, that must be his soul. Right? I mean, we all know that a scalpel will pass right through my soul. You know, but somehow that Marantia structure doesn't just pass through the earth. How does this work? Right, it's a big question that I can't answer. I don't understand how that all works. You know, that's why I say I'd love to have a secondary midwayer explain what we were just reading about to me.
That's for the next revelation.
Exactly, in what way are you close to me in energy? What is this knob you're turning that now I see you, now I don't? What is this relationship, you know? Because again, it's not really like you have, when all is said and done, you just have one energy. It's not really that you have, in an ultimate sense, spirit on this side and matter on this side and a vast gulf in between. Right? In some way, it's all one energy. Right? Does the Father relate to spirit substance and material substance differently? No, they're the same substance to Him. Right, so right, these are deep questions that I don't know the answer to, you know. But right, but you know, we know that you respond to not just physical stimuli, you respond to spirit stimuli, and there is a spirit environment, and so you got to wonder how much do they tweak us that way. You know, how much do they flavor our environment with spirit, and we unwittingly, you know, are stimulated by that. I don't know. All right. Okay, great. Great conversation there, and great speculations. So we'll get to that. Those that are a little bit less abstract to think about next time, the corporeal staff. We'll invariably get into thinking about our corporeal staff and some of those issues when we do, of course. A question or? Oh, okay. All right. Let's wrap it up there. Okay. Let's take a moment, everyone.